BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Thank you for listening to this download of Start the Week, presented by Tom Sutcliffe.
Hello. There's a famous story told about Diogenes, the Greek philosopher, which describes how Alexander the Great, when visiting Corinth, went to pay his respects to the celebrated thinker. The conqueror of empires asked whether there was anything he could do for Diogenes, who lived as a beggar in the streets. "Yes," Diogenes replied, "move out of the way, you're blocking my sunlight." It became a famous example of what the Greeks called parrhesia, free speaking or speaking truth to power. But how did that reckless candour shape itself into the philosophical school known as cynicism, and what has cynicism become now? Ansgar Allen from the University of Sheffield has some ideas because he's just published A Short History of Cynicism. And also concerned with what we've inherited from the ancients and how fairly it has been shared out, the classicist Edith Hall, Professor of Classics at King's College London and co-author of A People's History of Classics, a study of how ordinary working people got access to literature and learning that their self-styled betters would have preferred to keep for themselves. We are going to come on later to the only philosophical school to have regarded a fart as an acceptable form of argument, but I want to start with you, Edith. Okay. It is a polemical history, this. You want to change things, don't you? You write at the beginning about classics. It has been the curriculum of empire, but it can be the curriculum of liberation. Liberation from what?
Liberation from pretty much anything. The ancient Greeks argued about everything from abolition of slavery and radical egalitarian communism to the position of women to whether you should have republics or kings. And because they argued, we've got both sides of the argument from antiquity, which makes it a very, very good place to start any kind of consideration of change for the better today. They even invented the art of utopian thinking, imagining a better world that we could bring into existence, which is, to me, an absolutely obligatory antecedent of making any kind of change. You've got to imagine the better.
Your utopia would be one in which the classics are taught in every school, I think that I'm right in saying, or at least that would be one element of it.
Well, we have to be careful there. My utopia would be one in which the Greeks and Romans were available to everybody in every school. I'm not worried about Latin and Greek languages. I'm worried about people not even knowing, you know, what the first democracy was or who were the first theorists of republicanism.
So it's the content, and not the form that is crucial.
Yes.
And before we come on to how classics came to be so central to the education of the elite, could you just explain the etymology of the word classics? Because I didn't know this, and I found it absolutely fascinating. It ties them together in a knot, doesn't it? Class and classics.
Completely. And, you know, I've played around with all kinds of different pronunciations. When I was brought up in Nottingham, I would have definitely have said classics and class. I got given elocution lessons because I was a grammar school girl. And, of course, I've ended up saying classics and class. I sometimes play around with calling them classics and class. It just brings out that this terrible social hierarchy that we live in that even comes down to the length of your A's. OK, so a classicum was a war trumpet. And when the very earliest kings of Rome decided to decide what tax bands all their men were, they used a trumpet to summon them out into groups of the very rich, the quite rich, the fairly rich, the not rich, and the absolutely destitute. So by some sort of strange way, they became called classes, right? And so it originally means war trumpets, and actually meant that even in English until the early 17th century. So it's around the late 17th century that a particular phrase in just one ancient author, he talked about writers of a lower or a higher class, right? Meaning a metaphorical tax band. So you had lower class, and he called them proletarian authors, which are bad authors and authors in bad taste, and they're refined and upper class, patrician, classic-y authors. And so, ever since then, that was that was used to invent the name classics for studying the very best of the best, which of course were in Latin and Greek and had to be studied in Latin and Greek.
So how was it that classics came to be so central to the elite's sense of itself? Lord Shaftesbury writes a letter to his son and he says, Greek and Latin is absolutely necessary for everybody. The word illiterate in its common acceptant means a man who is ignorant of these two languages. How is it that that comes about?
What a snob. Okay, so in the late 17th century, there's a huge reshaping of education for well-off men in Britain. This is after the Restoration. And you've got this massive new rising mercantile class who want to play ruling class along with the old landed gentry. And where people had been taught separately, so the upper classes had been taught by private tutors, and the lower classes got nothing. More than half of men were illiterate in the 1700. The phenomenon of the private school mushroomed all over England and parts of the rest of the British Isles, where the curriculum was solely Latin and Greek literature, and you paid for somebody to batter Latin and Greek grammar into your teenage son for 8 years in order to prove that you didn't have to send him down a mine or to reap corn in the fields.
So it's a form of conspicuous consumption in a way.
It's absolutely a form of conspicuous consumption. It's a great big signal that we don't have to work from the age of five like hoi polloi and the plebs.
Ansgar Allen, you've written about education and meritocracy. The question of what you display merit in is always going to be a political one, isn't it, at some level?
Yes, it is. And I think what's interesting about the birth of meritocracy, which I trace to the 19th century, is that it begins with the co-option of the classics and the idea that the classics are the best means of deciding someone's merit. Well, meritocracy, by the way, is the idea that positions in society should be awarded on merit, not patronage, because of what one knows and not because of who one knows. And it was seen that the most important thing to know about was the classics. And I think it's quite interesting to see how people responded as the classics were co-opted to an examination system, which was first trialled in the Indian civil service to try and give positions to people based on merit rather than patronage. And Queen Victoria's got quite an interesting response to that. She was really concerned about the introduction of examinations in the civil service and was really worried that it would ensure that the right kind of person would occupy positions of responsibility.
Of course, there is a safety catch there, isn't there? Because if you set your exams in a subject that only those you would patronise anyway have access to, the system is going to work for you anyway.
It is, and that's why early meritocracy is an aristocratic form of meritocracy. But there were people who worked very hard to try and get access to these examinations as they were developed. And towards the end of the 19th century, a widespread fear developed about cramming and the possibility that people were learning classics in a very short space of time and they were not being bettered or improved through their learning, but they just learnt enough to pass the examination system.
Edith Hall, you yourself argue that a knowledge of the classics is an enormously enriching one. So was it just luck that they happened on Latin and Greek language teaching as this form of conspicuous consumption? It's not just that, is it? They also recognise something of value in this.
Yes, they did. And it was really a sort of Anglican sentiment and morality that was exactly perfect for the early days after the Act of Union in 1707, this idea of the sort of British gentleman and in which these pagan authors could be absolutely tolerated and indeed taken as examples of moral virtue. And this is partly where the cynics sort of come in, because one of the major features was the ancient secular philosophies, not just of Diogenes, of course, but in fact more of Plato and Aristotle. So it's the sort of humanist idea of gentleman. It also brings it, is very tightly bound up with the idea of taste. The idea of good taste turns up in the 18th century at exactly the same time as the concepts of classics and the concepts of class. And it's a combination of a sort of moral virtue, so that you show that you're sort of virtuous by having a particular kind of Palladian house with Greek pillars in it and a certain kind of neoclassical landscape. It's not just to show that you've got a refined aesthetic sensibility, but that you're actually morally superior as well.
There was some conflict here, wasn't there? Because from the start, there were people who said, well, actually, this is dangerous knowledge. Both Hobbes and Burke say, be careful with this stuff because it's volatile. If you teach it to the wrong people, things go wrong.
Yeah, so the whole idea was that you didn't teach it to the wrong people by making it only available in Latin and Greek, which required that great long secondary and tertiary education that I've been talking about. You absolutely guaranteed that the people who Edmund Burke called, the swinish multitude, would never be able to get hold of Latin and Greek. So almost from the beginning, though, with all of this, by 1700, you've got hugely polemical people saying, what is wrong with reading these guys in translation? You know, we've got this fantastic translation of the Aeneid by Dryden. You know, what is wrong with reading it in English? If our schoolboys and everybody else get access to these things in their native tongue, they can read the lot. They can read all of it. They can become very accomplished classicists and still have time for learning all the other skills that you need to be a modern citizen. This was very much Tom Paine's line. People think he was anti-classics. He wasn't. He was anti years and years and years and years of grammar. Rote learning. What he wanted was everybody to read the great philosophers, the great historians, and be able to have proper philosophical and political discussions rooted in the whole European tradition of philosophy and political theory and history. And I very much hold this position now, despite the fact that I'm a professor of classics and was lucky enough to get access to Greek as one of the very last beneficiaries of the Butler Education Act. I'm quite convinced that all of our teenagers ought to be getting a contact with the ancient Greeks and Romans in translation. And that's why I'm leading a campaign to get classical civilization and or ancient history qualifications into every state school and state sixth form college in the land.
How did people get access, as it were, in the early 18th century? There seems to be a sort of sense of almost a trickle-down theory of culture that...
Well, it wasn't trickle down. It didn't trickle down. You had to grab it from the bottom up. Unless you were very, very lucky, it was almost impossible. Crucially, it was the secondhand book market that you could pick up, especially when Pope's Iliad and Odyssey got translated. We find them for incredibly small amounts of money on secondhand book markets. For example, my co-author, who I must mention here, Dr. Henry Stead, who's lecturing Latin at St. Andrews, he discovered all these amazing small printers and printing presses and secondhand book markets going on in places like Haddington in the Borders.
You have a lot of hero publishers in your book, as well as hero autodidacts.
And so many of them were actually nonconformists. The reason I mentioned Anglican earlier was that, you know, the posh people got up through the Anglican Church. Dissenters, Methodists and Baptists and Presbyterians, couldn't even go to Oxford or Cambridge, and they couldn't get into Parliament and all that kind of thing. And they realised, as Locke had done, that a lot about arguing for their own liberties depended on getting their heads down in the ancient Greek and Roman authors. So you have a massive, massive nonconformist contribution in the 18th century, nonconformist schools. But
it's interesting, isn't it, how they use that elite education. John Thelwell, a radical orator, points out at one point, he says, you know, you can't quote Paine and the contemporary pamphleteers because you'll be accused of high treason. You may well actually go to prison. But Socrates and Plato, Tully and Demosthenes may be eloquent in the same cause. You could use these great ancient authorities and nobody could touch you because...
I love that, man. I love John Thelwell. So he went round, and this is in the 1790s after the French Revolution, when British radical Democrats were trying to get a Republican constitution. And he taught himself a class lecturing classical history. And he travelled all the south of England lecturing on Roman history, where everybody knew when he said, you know, Brutus, he meant Tom Paine or Robespierre, right? There was just kind of allegorical code. He didn't manage to stay out of prison any more than most of those radical Democrats, I have to say. But he did make a difference.
I want to turn on to cynicism now. But before I do, I just want to ask you a question. Throughout the book, people take on classical names. They have the figure of Spartacus is a great figure for radicals. Prometheus, the Gracchi. All of these are called in aid of their own arguments. Strangely, Diogenes isn't. You would have thought he would have been a marvellous example of speaking truth to power. He doesn't seem to figure much.
Well, there's not an awful lot about him, as we're about to hear. He didn't leave any of his own writings for anybody to read. You couldn't, in your workers' library in One Lock Head in Scotland, and it was the very first workers' library in the country, was at a lead mine in One Lock Head. You know, you couldn't put a copy of Diogenes on your shelf, whereas you could, and they did, all put copies of the Epicurean philosophers like Lucretius and the Stoic thinkers and Plato and Aristotle. Poor old Diogenes got very short shrift.
Ansgar Allen, as Edith had just said, there is no formal body of Cynic knowledge. It doesn't have books. It's even slightly contemptuous of the notion of books. So who really shapes this into a school of philosophy?
Well, I think it's retrospectively shaped into a school of philosophy. So as Edith has said, we don't really have any direct texts from Diogenes, who's the most famous ancient Cynic, who's lived in the 4th century BCE and a contemporary of Plato. So as a philosophy, it remains evasive for that reason. It was passed on initially by direct lived examples. These examples became stories, and then they were finally collected in large collections of anecdotes. And I think this makes Cynicism quite unusual when compared to other ancient philosophies, which have their founding texts that you could put on the shelf and identify with the author. And I think if you look at the anecdotes, what you find is a radical improvised philosophy that has no rules or doctrines or easily identifiable teachings. Mm. And it was also something which was a very marginal activity. So although anybody can be a Cynic today, indeed there's the expression, everyone's a Cynic, in ancient Greece, Cynicism was only practiced by a very tiny group of eccentrics.
Give us some example. Diogenes is the most famous of the Cynics.
You've mentioned the encounter with Alexander the Great, which is probably one of the most famous anecdotes describing Diogenes. Another famous anecdote is a little bit more scatological. It's the anecdote which is about Diogenes emptying his bowels in front of an audience. And this is quite an interesting anecdote to think about, because I think it demonstrates some really important features of ancient Cynicism. So in this anecdote, what happens is that Diogenes gives a public oration, which is very well received. But it's precisely at the moment when his audience starts to really enjoy what he's saying that he squats before them and empties his bowels. Now, one interpretation of this is that now he has nothing else to lose. So the point of disgracing himself like that in front of his audience is to say, look, I've got nothing else to hide. Now is the point to begin listening. Another interpretation is to say, well, what the Cynic is doing here is saying, look, you're ashamed and repelled by the wrong things. So you might express disgust at what I'm doing here, but you're happy to live with all sorts of other disgusting and disgraceful behavior, such as greed, patronage, vast inequalities, and so on. But you don't have the same kind of visceral response to that. So, you know, why is that? But I think that there could be something else going on here as well. And what's really interesting about what Diogenes does is he doesn't just empty his bowels at any moment. He situates that this Cynic act very precisely. He does it when his audience is most enraptured.
Timing seems critical here, doesn't it? You have another line. Crates, who was Diogenes' pupil, famously converted Metricles to Cynicism with a well-timed and kindly fart. I spent some time trying to work out what a kindly fart would sound like, but well-timed, I can see.
Well-timed, yes.
It's an interruption, a punctuation of rational speech with something else. Is that right?
Yes. So Cynicism wasn't a theoretical philosophy. It doesn't explain itself or set out the principles that underlie its practices. It does things which are deliberately intended to confuse and upset us. And what it's often doing is expressing different forms of criticism that are directed at some of the dominant cultural norms that surround us. But what it doesn't do is it doesn't explain what it finds objectionable or what we should find objectionable in that culture. Instead, I think it invites us to think, well, why is the Cynic expressing so much contempt here? What could possibly have upset them so much that they do this and disgrace themselves in this manner before us?
So how does it survive? I mean, you seem to suggest there are two routes, that it survives in practitioners, street cynics, and then it survives by being co-opted and essentially betrayed by succeeding writers.
Yes, so it's got a very, very long history. And one interesting point in that history, for example, is Emperor Julian in the 4th century. He writes, the Roman Emperor Julian writes against what he sees as the street cynics who are begging and preaching throughout the cities of the empire. And what this shows is that there are large groups of cynics who are roaming around the empire now, which is quite different from ancient cynicism in Athens, in ancient Greece, for instance, where cynics are marginal eccentrics. You only have a handful. So it shows that cynicism has become a force to be reckoned with, something that would make an emperor worried about his rule. But what Julian does here, which is really interesting, is that he then co-opts cynicism. So he says, look, this is the bad, debased, lower form of cynicism. And what I have here is a model of a much purer, nobler cynicism, which is self-sufficient, courageous, it's bold. I think we have an emperor's cynicism, where it's the cynicism of someone who tells others what they don't want to hear. And then the early Christian ascetics are really interesting because they take up and adapt a very different set of cynic ideas associated more with the street cynics that Julian rejected. So from cynicism, they take the idea that practice is more important than theory and the importance of impoverishment and rejecting material distractions, for instance.
Edith Hall, how does that, within the classical world, how is Diogenes' thought taken on? Do you see it as being co-opted and tamed?
Yeah, up to a point. Talking about Emperor Julian is incredibly interesting because he was regarded as noisome and hairy and sort of generally uncivilized by the civilized Greeks of the Roman Empire in his day. But no, there's a very particular text, which is by an author called Diogenes Laertius, which is a biography. He collected biographies of famous thinkers and philosophers and did lives of people like Aristotle and Plato and all of them. And in his life is the source of almost all the witty quips that people quoted in antiquity. For example, you know, Plato and Aristotle at the Academy had decided to define man, humankind, as a featherless biped, right? They were introducing classifications. So the story goes, and Diogenes Laertius tells us that Diogenes one day wandered into the Academy, no doubt, you know, completely filthy and covered with dog poo, and with a plucked chicken, and said, "Behold, I bring you a man." Okay. Now, that one and the sunlight one, and there are very, very, very many other, and they're very funny, but they all come from this one particular, rather obscure Hellenistic text. But they became so popular. A lot of these scenes are actually painted in the early modern period. You know, he at that point, in the sort of Baroque era, Diogenes became quite popular.
I'm glad you've raised the issue of humour, because that seems a particularly modern aspect, or seemed to me a particularly modern aspect of Diogenes' approach. It is meme-like, isn't it? He creates these ideas which are immediately repeatable. Ansgar Allen, I mean,
I'm not so sure about that. Okay. So I think cynic humour is really important, but it's a very aggressive form of humour. It's a humour which is at the point of turning over into something which becomes aggression. So there's the anecdote of Diogenes encounters someone who wants to study with him, and he says, "Okay, you want to study with me? We'll carry this cheese, and you have to follow me around with this cheese." And the person throws away the cheese, disgusted that he's been invited to do this, because to follow Diogenes with a piece of cheese would be to act as if you were his slave, which would be an unbearable humiliation. So there is some kind of humour happening here in this example, but it's at the expense of the student who doesn't understand that to practice Cynic philosophy, you have to undergo humiliation and shame. I think the examples of critique that we have from Diogenes and other ancient cynics were very specific, targeted critiques designed to insult the culture that they were surrounded by. So they're not directly translatable. So you say meme-like, well meme is the idea of something spreading and being imitated. I don't think that cynicism set itself up to be imitated in that sense.
I'll confess it slightly came into my mind because there is a Banksy.
Yes.
A Banksy piece of graffiti. And it consists of the quotation, "One original thought is worth 1,000 mindless quotings," yeah. In quotation marks, Diogenes. Which, of course, I think Banksy is aware of the irony of quoting somebody against quoting, but it then becomes itself a T-shirt, a meme. It's endlessly repeated.
Yes, yeah, so that might be taken as an example of modern cynicism, which is tends to be seen as a form of unreflective cynicism. I think that the really nice example of this quote is that it's beautifully absurd. So the act of quoting potentially undermines the argument. And this is quite an interesting example of cynicism as a form of critique which also attacks itself, which doesn't seek to elevate itself, but also undermines itself through the act of its own critique.
Is that what you mean when you say the problem with modern cynics is that they're not yet disappointed enough? That we're not thinking hard enough about it if we just say, well, I don't trust anybody, or they're all in it together, or they're all the same?
Yes, I think one of the problems with modern cynicism is it's often a way of retreating from the criticism which has just been expressed. So after saying something cynical, you might remark, you know, so I've said my piece. It can be a way of letting off steam or an excuse for moving on. So you find criticisms within modern cynicism, but they're often underdeveloped, or we might be shy of expressing them. By contrast, the ancient cynics who were really wanted to be heard and wanted to shout out their cynicisms, today we tend to keep them quiet and we're ashamed of them because we think that they show something negative about ourselves and our own characters.
Edith Hoare, do you see any true inheritors of cynicism in the modern world?
I think Banksy is one. Because each one of his murals pops up unexpectedly, and it's very, very compressed and compact, and takes a lot of thinking about. I think.
But then, unfortunately, gets sold for $250,000 by whoever's.
I'm fully aware of that. I think the humour is extraordinarily important. And there's two things I'd say there. One is Diogenes actually came from so far to the east of the Black Sea that he practically was a barbarian. He came from a city called Sinope, famous for comic authors. It only produced comedians. It was just a place where comedy was the mode of life. It's a bit like rapping Liverpudlians or something. And some people have even suggested it's some kind of frontier humour that he's absorbed from the Scythians of the Black Sea or something, and it's semi-barbarous. And in connection with that, those Scythians are nomads and they're living much, much closer to the earth. And there is one underlying theory in all of ancient cynicism right from the beginning, and that is that it's anti-culture. The Greeks split nature and culture very, very early on, the philosophers. And Diogenes absolutely repudiated everything that wasn't just animal in man. So he wasn't going to have a family. He wasn't going to live in a house. He didn't want to have fellow citizens. He didn't want to have emperors. I can't think of very many people equivalent to that, except the people who go off and try and live in the woods, live off the land, and completely repudiate even the internet.
Anyway, we have run out of time, I'm afraid. Thank you. Thank you to both of my guests. Edith Hoare's A People's History of Classics, co-authored with Henry Stead, and Ansgar Allen's Cynicism are both out now in book and e-form. A big thank you to Duncan Hannan, today's studio manager. Next week, Andrew Marr looks to the future. But for now, thank you and goodbye.
There's more information about Start the Week on the programme's website. Go to bbc.co.uk, where you'll also find many more Radio 4 programmes you can download for free.